Well, there's a second reading that I'd like to read with you now in the Old Testament on page 516. That's Psalm 120, a song of ascents. In my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. Deliver me, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. What shall be given to you, and what more shall be done to you, O deceitful tongue? A warrior's sharp arrows with glowing coals from the broom tree. Woe to me that I sojourn in Meshech, that I dwell among the tents of Kedar. Too long have I had my dwelling among those who hate peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. Page 516. We've already read the Psalm 120. We finished a few weeks ago. We finished our studies in Judges and then Ruth, and we've been looking at Isaiah, chapter 9, verse 6 in particular, over the Christmas period, and I just wanted to begin something new with you this evening, and I want to stay in the Old Testament for a few more weeks at least, and I want to come to this collection of psalms that are known as the Songs of Ascent. One commentary describes them as brilliant, brief, and beautiful, and that's true. At least most of them are very brief. But they're all brilliant and beautiful as well. And they all share this common title. You notice at the beginning of each psalm from from 120 onwards to 134, they all begin with that title, a song of ascents. But why are they called the psalms of ascent or the songs of ascent? There's been various suggestions down through the years as to why they have this title. Some have suggested, for example, that these psalms were the psalms that were particularly sung at the time when the remnant from Israel returned from their captivity in Babylon. That's certainly, I think, a possibility. Psalm 126, for example, lends itself and speaks directly to that time, so there's a possibility that some of them were sung at that time, and they particularly sort of founded a kind of a hymn book at that time regarding of these psalms. Others have suggested that these were the psalms that were used by the priests as they went up the steps in the temple, and again that is possible. There were apparently 15 steps in all. Seven to the outer court and then eight to the inner court. And so again, it's a possibility that these psalms were sung by the priests as they ascended the steps in the temple in Jerusalem. Others have explained and see here that really what we have is a series of psalms that are simply, they ascend in their structure. And so you can certainly tell in some of the psalms that there does seem to be a build-up to a kind of a climax at the end of the psalms. I wouldn't say that's perhaps true of all of them, but some people have explained this title in that way. And then lastly, some others have explained this title in the sense that these were the psalms that were sung by the pilgrims in Israel every time they went up to the feasts in Jerusalem. Three times a year, all of the males in Israel were expected to go up to Jerusalem. And it didn't matter how far away they were or how busy they were. Three times a year, they were expected to go up to Jerusalem to celebrate the feasts. And I think it's a beautiful image, really. But you can just imagine them as they gather together. First of all, all of the men from one particular village, and they set off down certain tracks, perhaps, that they're well-beaten tracks in the past on the way up to Jerusalem. And as they go on their way, like a little stream of males, of men as they're on the way. Suddenly they meet the men from another village, perhaps, and they'd form a bigger group. And then a bigger group still, and it's all like little streams flowing into one big river, as it were, and then finally reaching up to Jerusalem. And you can just imagine them, can't you, singing these psalms as they go up on their way. And again, Psalm 122 certainly seems to lend itself to that picture and that interpretation, that understanding of these songs of ascent. I think there's possibility in all of those suggestions. But the truth of the matter is we can't really be that dogmatic. We don't really know what the historical setting was and why these are called songs of ascent. But there is one thing that is clear. And that is that all of these psalms speak to us of progress. I like to look at these psalms as almost like the Pilgrim's Progress of the Old Testament. And that's why I want to spend just a few weeks, the next 15 weeks, looking at these psalms one at a time with you on Sunday evenings. Someone once said to David Livingstone while he was at home resting between expeditions, somebody came up to him and said, "Where are you planning to go to next?" And the story goes that his answer was, "Anywhere, so long as it's forward." And, you know, there's a sense in which that really ought to be the attitude of every believer, isn't it? We shouldn't be content to merely be static. We're not meant to tread water or just mark time. We are to have that same attitude that Paul commends to us in that passage that we read in Philippians chapter 3. You remember how he puts it there in verse 12 in particular and onwards. He says, "Not that I've already obtained this or am already perfect or mature, but I press on to make it my own because Christ Jesus has made me his own. Brothers, I do not consider that I've made it my own, but one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and straining forwards to what lies ahead, I press on towards the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Let those of us who are mature think this way. And if in anything you think otherwise, God will reveal that also to you. Only let us hold true to what we have attained." It's so important, isn't it, to remember the apostle's words there at that point. He's writing after 30 years as a believer. I don't know how long you've been a Christian. Some of you just a short amount of time, perhaps, but some of us have been believers for many, many years, and we look back upon our Christian lives, and where are we compared to where we were? How far down the road are we, perhaps? You know, Paul says that the Christian life is an upward call, an upward call. And he says, "I haven't arrived yet." This is the apostle. "I haven't arrived yet." And so any Christian that gives you the impression that they have, well, they're suspect, aren't they? Something's terribly wrong. Or if we give the impression that we're simply content to stand still, then there's something wrong with us, isn't there? This is how we are all meant to be, says the Apostle Paul. He says all of us who are mature should think this way. In other words, that's everybody, isn't it? If the mature are supposed to think, "Well, we haven't arrived yet," how much more those who are not mature? I still have a way to go. And isn't that why the Bible, again and again, particularly in the New Testament, Paul describes the Christian life almost, well, in terms of a race, doesn't he? But not as a sprint, but more in terms of a marathon. And that's the picture that he's using there, isn't it? I don't look behind at things that have gone behind, he says, but I press on towards the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. This is the attitude of the Apostle Paul. He's like a cross-country runner. I don't know if you've ever... Well, I don't suppose any of us have done a marathon. I might be wrong. I certainly never raced a marathon. The nearest thing I've ever experience myself. I can remember his cross country in school, and I hated it. But our teacher, he was absolutely insistent and would never let us play football or anything that we enjoyed. Well, we had to go on this cross-country run all the time. And it must have been just a couple of miles, I suppose, now when I think about it. You know, out of the school and up the lane and across the fields and round and round again and two laps and back again and so on. But we used to moan all the way, and it was just so... Any way of getting out of it, we tried. But one thing we did find, however, was that the best way to get round, the best way to do it was to set yourself markers. And sometimes, you know, even just to get through it, not because you enjoyed it, but just to get through it, to set yourself markers and even time yourself before you got to those markers. And so you would push yourself to try and see if you could beat yourself from last time and so on. And I think that was a good way of doing it, because it sort of got you into it a little bit, and there were certain goals that you had to aim for. And if I can put it that way, that's what these psalms are all about, isn't it? These psalms of ascent. They're like the markers along the way. Not in a mechanical kind of way. You know, we're not to come to these psalms and say, oh, well, I've done that one and I can tick that one off and move on to the next. It's not in some mechanical way like that, but there is a note of progression in all of these psalms. And they're like markers along the way, and they're kind of tests of our spirituality and where we are and how far down the road really are we. So I just want to spend a little bit of time this evening in the first psalm, in Psalm 120. We read it earlier in the service. It's very, very brief. But just to say three things about this psalm. And that is, the first of all, to notice his distress. Notice the psalmist's distress. He says, in my distress I called to the Lord and he answered me. Deliver me, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. Now it seems, doesn't it, very straightforward at the beginning. It seems that the psalmist, of course, has been, he's been a victim of lies and deceit. And it may be David. We're not told that this was a psalm of David. It probably was, but his name doesn't appear at the beginning there. But it may be that he was at one of those moments in his life when he was a victim of some form of deceit, and somebody had it in for him and so on, and he was suffering as a result. And so he cries out and says, Lord, deliver me from lying lips and a deceitful tongue. And so it seems very straightforward, doesn't it, that that's what this psalm is about. But then in verses 5 and 6, something else happens. He mentions something else, and now it seems there's more to it, isn't there, than just being the victim of lying lips and a deceitful tongue. Look at what he says in verse 5. He says, woe to me that I sojourn in Meshech, that I dwell among the tents of Kedar. Too long have I had my dwelling among those who hate peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. What's he saying now? Well, it seems as though he's complaining that he's been living in the wrong place, doesn't he? He says, I sojourn in Meshech, and that I dwell among the tents of Kedar. What's that all about? Why does the psalmist write, tell us about those two names and that he lives there? Well, this isn't literal. We can't possibly understand the psalmist as speaking literally here. For one reason, because you can't live in two places at once. And they are two very different places. He's not speaking literally. Kedar was up by Damascus somewhere, and Meshech was even further still. Many believe it was somewhere in modern-day Turkey. So we're not to understand the psalmist as talking in a literal way here. We need to remember that this is poetry, but the point that he's making is very clear, isn't it? Both of these places are outside of Israel. And he's saying, far too long have I been living somewhere where I ought not to be. He's in spiritual exile, you see. He's complaining that he's been living outside of Israel. He's not literally, he is in Israel, literally. But it's almost as though he's been living amongst the tents of Kedar, and he's living in Meshech, and he's in spiritual exile. Do you see what he's saying? Do you see his complaints? Do you see why he's in distress? What we see here, surely, is the awakening of a desire of a man of God that wants to come home. He's discontent with living in the world. He's been living there too long, he's saying. And isn't that where all spiritual progression begins? Isn't that always the first step? He wants to ascend the ladder. But he has to begin on the bottom rung. And that's where we need to begin, isn't it? If we're to progress at all spiritually. You see what the psalmist is saying? He's humbling himself before God, isn't he? But he's confessing before the Lord that he has been far too long away from home, far too long away from God. And I wonder whether that is our complaint this evening. Lord, I'm not where I ought to be, and I'm sick and tired of being there. Isn't that what he's saying? I don't want to be here anymore. The world bothers me. I'm fed up of living in the world. I've been dwelling amongst the tents of Kedar, he says. Here we are at the end of 2018. Incredible how time flies, isn't it? Another year's gone by. And we tend at times like this, and I think rightly so, it's good for us to do so, we tend at the end of another year to just sort of notice, don't we, where we are. And we ask ourselves questions. Well, where am I spiritually? And that's good for us to ask. But a good question to ask yourself at this time is this, isn't it? Does living in this world cause you distress to your soul? You know what our problem is? Adaptability. Isn't it? Adaptability is a good thing normally, isn't it? You know, we go through the seasons, and when the summer comes along, we're all complaining because it's too hot. But then we go through the weeks and we get used to it, and most of you do anyway, I don't know. You seem to enjoy it and the heat, and so we adapt, don't we? And then we sort of, slip off a bit and we cool down and so on, and we adapt. And then the winter comes along and we're all moaning again because it's too cold. But soon the coats come on and we're adapting again, and we get used to it and so on, and that's what we're like, isn't it? And that's a good thing in the world, in the world in a sense, isn't it? It's a good thing for us to be able to adapt normally, but spiritually, that's a problem. It's a big problem, isn't it? I can remember when we first went to Spain in 1991. The shock, the culture shock it was for me. I can remember some of the things that I saw on TV that I would never have seen in England. When there's an accident or war on the news, for example, they think nothing of showing dead bodies and all sorts of things over the TV, and that's kind of normal. That was quite shocking. And the level of nudity was quite shocking as well, I found, at that time. But I got used to it, to my shame. You do. And then when I came back to England, it was a shock again, because England had changed so much in 9 years. And there were things on the TV now that I wasn't expecting. And again, it was a shock to come back and so on. But again, we get used to it, don't we? That's the way we are. But that's a problem, you see. And what this psalmist is confessing here in verses 5 and 6 is this, isn't it? He says, I'm living in the world. I'm living outside of Israel. I'm living in spiritual exile. And I've been there too long. And now he realizes it, doesn't he? And he's sick and tired of it. Well, I wonder if we know something of that. At the end of 2018, as we come into a new year, Do we know anything of that distress? Or are we just comfortable? Have we adapted ourselves so much that we're not bothered at all by it? Are we just used to it? Where are we? He's distressed, isn't he, by living in the world? But then notice, secondly, the deliverance that he speaks of there. He cries out in verses 1 and 2 again. He says, "In my distress I called to the Lord, and he answered me. Deliver me, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue." Lying lips and a deceitful tongue. Isn't that one of the main characteristics of the world in which we live? Lies and deceit, sharp tongues and hostility. Isn't that the atmosphere that we live in, that this world is? It shouldn't surprise us, should it? Of course, because we're told that the God of this world, the devil, well, he's been a liar from the beginning, hasn't he? And we see that in Genesis. He's a liar right from the beginning. And so it's bound to be that the atmosphere of this world is the same. The whole world, says John, lies in the power of the evil one. And so there's bound to be this falsehood and hypocrisy and the flattery and the superficiality of it all, isn't there? But don't you just want to be free of it? Don't you just long to be able to get out of it? To rid yourself of these things? That's part of what the apostle is speaking of here. But there's, again, like the first point, there's something more here, isn't there? He's troubled by something else, isn't he? It doesn't come out so clearly in our translation, but in the authorized version, for example, in verse 2, it says, "Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips." He's talking about something in the spiritual realm, isn't he? He says it again in verse 6. "Too long my soul has dwelt amongst those who hate peace." And so there's this spiritual aspect. "Deliver my soul," he says. He's not just concerned about the effects of lies in his own life and the deceit that he's had to suffer and the suffering that he's going through because of the things that people say. But surely what he's concerned about here is the influence of the world and these lying lips in himself, in his soul. He recognizes these things in himself. Do you remember Isaiah chapter 6? That incredible vision of the Lord. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. And the train of his robe filled the temple." And it's this wonderful vision of holiness, the holiness of God, the angels that can't look upon him. And they bear these burning coals from off the altar and so on. And it's just an absolute wonderful, awesome picture of the holiness of God, isn't it? I think we often forget that chapter isn't rocket science, but it comes after chapter 5. Funny to say. But when you read chapter 5, there's something missing. In chapter 5, chapters 1 to 5 really, Lloyd-Jones wrote there's a series of sermons published by Lloyd-Jones, and the title of the book is A Nation Under Wrath. And it's all based on Isaiah chapters 1 to 5. But the interesting thing about chapter 5 is this: there are 6 woes that are pronounced. So in verse 8 he says, "Woe to those who join house to house and add field to field until there is no more room," and so on. And then in verse 11, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may run after strong drink. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes." And there's this series of 6 woes, but you wonder, where's the 7th? Because 7 is the normal number. You remember in Matthew 23, the Lord Jesus himself, he pronounces woes on the Pharisees and the scribes, and there's 7 of them. Because 7 is the number of perfection. But there's one missing. It's in chapter 6, isn't it? When he sees the Lord, what is it he says? "Woe is me. Woe is me." In chapter 5, he's pronouncing judgment. It's a chapter all about judgment, the judgment of God coming upon the nation. But then in chapter 6, he says, no, woe is me, for I am lost. Why is it that he's lost? Why does he pronounce woe upon himself? Because he lives among a people of unclean lips, and he is one. And he's realized now, hasn't he? He sees the Lord and he realizes that it's me. It's me. I live amongst the people of unclean lips, but I am one. There's not much difference between us, you see. There he is pronouncing judgment in chapter 5. But I'm going to be judged. You see what he's saying? The water's getting in the boat. I've been living in the world as well. I need bailing out myself. And that's the problem that we have here in this psalm, isn't it? Woe is me, he says, that I sojourn in Meshech, that I dwell amongst the tents of Kedar. Do you see what he's saying? This is a problem to me. You see, I see it in myself. This lying lips and this deceitful tongue, these terrible things that I've suffered. Oh, but am I any different? I'm just the same. And we need to ask ourselves, don't we? If we want to make any spiritual progress, we do. We need to ask ourselves. The New Testament says that we are pilgrims, doesn't it? We don't live here. This isn't our home. Oh, but we settle down, don't we? And we find ourselves very at home, very often. And it doesn't distress us as it ought to. Why not? Because it's in us. How can we see that? How do we know that that's true and that I'm not just being negative and giving you all a bashing this evening? How do we know that that's true? Are you worldly? Am I worldly? Or are we spiritual? It's very easy, you know, to point the finger and cry worldly at those who don't do the things that we say you shouldn't. Get me mixed up. You know what I mean? It's very easy to point the finger and say worldly. You know, there are some Christians, oh, you shouldn't watch TV. And then someone comes along and says, oh, they watch TV. Oh, you're a very worldly Christian. Or something along those lines. You know what it's like. It's very easy to say worldly in that kind of situation, isn't it? But it's our lips that give us away, isn't it? It's our lips. You remember what Jesus says in Luke? He says, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. What does he mean? Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Well, you know what it's like. Just imagine, for example, being at a party of some sort, maybe, and somebody fills your glass, but it's just too full. You know, when it's just right and there's that little gap at the top, that's okay. But then just imagine somebody fills it too full and it's right to the brim, and then you're on your way back to where your seat is, maybe, and you're just walking through the crowd and somebody gives you a little nudge, and somebody without knowing just turns around and moves in a direction you're not expecting. And what happens? The overflow just spills out, doesn't it? If it was the right amount in there, you'd probably be able to manage. But it's just because it's too full, isn't it? That's what comes out. And that's surely what Jesus is saying in that phrase. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. It's when somebody knocks you in this life. What comes out then? Because that's what you see. That's when you see what's really in the heart. It's in the overflow of the heart that the mouth speaks, he says. What happens when somebody elbows you? What happens when you receive some knocks in this life? It's our tongue that gives us away, isn't it? Your tongue tells you an awful lot about yourself, doesn't it? What comes out when no one else is around? You remember you used to go to the doctor. I'm not so sure they do this anymore or not. We used to go to the doctor and the first thing they'd say, stick your tongue out. And somehow, just looking at your tongue, they were able to tell whatever was wrong with you. I don't know how they do it, but just looking at your tongue, it was such an important part, wasn't it? Such an important part of the assessment. And that's what the Bible tells us, doesn't it? That's what Jesus is talking about. It's the gossip and the lies and the criticism and the boasting and the slander and the hypocrisy and the sharpness of our tongues and our hostility to one another and all of these things. They're the things that tell us what's really going on inside. And can any of us say that we're immune to those things? That they're not in us? No wonder the psalmist says, woe to me that I sojourn in Meshech and that I dwell among the tents of Kedar. It's our tongues that betray us. That's what marked out our Lord as being different, wasn't it? You remember how Peter puts it in 1 Peter? Let me just quote from 1 Peter there. He says, he committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. Because that's the evidence, you see. That's the crowning evidence, isn't it? No, he committed no sin. How do we know that? There wasn't even any deceit found in his mouth. He was sinless. He was perfect. He was different to us. And so the psalmist cries out for deliverance. Lord, deliver me from lying lips and a deceitful tongue, but not just theirs who are causing me the trouble. Lord, deliver me from my own tongue, my own lips. Deliver me from the effects and the influence of the world in which I'm living. Deliver me from its influence in my own heart. Well, thirdly and lastly, he speaks to us about his danger. Look at verses 3 and 4. What shall be given to you and what more shall be done to you, O deceitful tongue? A warrior's sharp arrows and with glowing coals from the broom tree. Now don't misunderstand those words. The psalmist isn't seeking revenge at that point. He's not sort of wishing this terrible judgment upon those who have caused him trouble. He's not seeking revenge in that sense. But he is recognizing God's righteous judgment on us. And he speaks about the wood from the broom tree, the glowing coals from the broom tree, which is said to have been the wood that burnt the hottest and the longest. And so they're words of warning, aren't they? They're words of warning to all of us. We need to take them seriously, don't we? Jesus had some very strong words to say, didn't he? About the words that we speak. He says, I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give an account for every careless word they speak. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. I don't know about you, but those words come as a bit of a shock to me. Now, we're evangelicals. We're Christians. We believe in justification through faith alone, don't we? And Jesus says, you'll be justified by your words, or you'll be condemned by your words. Why does he say that? Is he denying that truth of the justification through faith alone? Salvation through faith alone? No, he's not denying it, but what he is saying is this: the proof of it isn't what you say, isn't it? You'll be justified regarding your profession of faith on your words, or you'll be condemned on your words. It's the words that give us away again, isn't it? It's the same thing. James, you remember what he says in his epistle? James chapter 1, again, some very cutting words, aren't they? Very hard. He says, if anyone thinks he's religious and doesn't bridle his tongue, but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless. It's worthless. Oh, but I believe in Jesus. I've been a Christian for many, many years. But if there's no control of the tongue, says James, your profession is worthless. Matthew Henry says, if your religion has done nothing to control your temper, you can be absolutely assured that it's done nothing to save your soul either. You're just kidding yourself. You're deceiving your own heart, says James. It's that serious, isn't it? The way we speak, the control of our lips and our tongue. It's so, so important. That's the danger that he talks about here in this psalm. I almost feel as though I want to stop. This is the first step in spiritual progress. I don't know if you remember the story of the pastor that moved into a new church. And the first he was told before he got there, he knew that there was a great problem with division and people arguing and so on. And so the first week he was there, he preached a sermon on the need to love one another. And out the door, everybody was going through the door and shaking his hand and saying, oh, thank you, Pastor. It was a wonderful sermon. And we look forward to hearing you again and so on. And the second week came along and he preached exactly the same sermon again. Just repeated himself. And the people started going through the door afterwards and thought to themselves, well, lapse of memory maybe. He's forgotten that he preached that last week, so we'll just forgive him. Don't say anything, you know, just let it go. And so they shook his hand and said, thank you for the sermon again and so on. And third week came along, he preached exactly the same sermon again. And this time they were getting a bit exasperated. And so somebody mentioned it to him on the door and said, but didn't you realise you preached that the first week and last week as well? And so the pastor said, yeah, but you haven't done it yet, have you? You haven't learnt the lesson. And you know, there's a sense in which I think that's, we need to do that sometimes. Just stop, pause. We're going to go through the Psalms of Ascent. Oh, good. That'll be interesting. No. If it doesn't mean anything to us, if it's not something that we do, it's going to mean nothing, isn't it? This is spiritual progress, but we have to begin here. We have to put our foot on the bottom rung, don't we? Do you see the point? It has to be more than that. Because there will be no second step unless this is taken seriously. Let me ask you, what's the sign of spirituality in a church or in us individually? If you ask the charismatics, they'll say speaking in tongues. I've got enough trouble controlling the one I've got, let alone have any more. I don't need any more. I've got problems with this one, with my heart and with my tongue, haven't you? And that's what the psalmist is saying, isn't it? He's saying, Lord, deliver me, because I can't do it. It's that important, but I can't do it. You see, that's his complaint, isn't it? He looks at himself and he looks at these people that are causing him the problem. These people who are causing him to suffer because of their lies and deceit. But then he looks at himself and says, woe is me. There's too little difference between me and the world in which I'm living. And that ought to distress us, brothers and sisters. It ought to be a cause of complaint, a cause of anguish for us. We ought to be on our knees and saying, Lord, awaken in me a desire to come home. I've been away too long. But Lord, I confess that I'm far too comfortable where I am. We need to start there, don't we? In poverty of spirit, in brokenness before him. Not all of the Psalms of Ascent are like this, you'll be glad to know. But this one is a lamentation, This one is a sad psalm, isn't it? This is a psalm of confession. This is a psalm. There's others that are full of joy and hope and wonderful glory, and we'll see that over the weeks, hopefully. But we have to start here. Hunger and thirsting for righteousness, because it's not in us. We're too much like the world, aren't we? Aren't we?